I might point out that the junkie priest is how Father Egan has come to be known. It doesn't mean that, in fact, he himself was a junkie, but could you tell us briefly, Father, how you came to get this catchy nickname?
Well, 15 years ago, there was no status working with drug addicts. Today, I'm riding on the crest of certain popularity, but 15 years ago, when I was called the junkie priest, was first out of derision by some doctors who felt threatened. They weren't doing their thing, so I was doing their thing for them. And some police, not all, called me the junkie priest because it was a very unpopular thing to work with a junkie. In New York City, we have about 100,000 drug addicts, and maybe about 95% of them are heroin addicts. And a heroin addict is a junkie, and I was working with heroin addicts for so many years, I was called the junkie priest, period.
Could you just briefly tell us what Village Haven is, why it's there, and what it does?
The Village Haven is first of all, it's a place. It's a therapeutic community staffed by professional people. I'm the founder of it. And the staff of the Village Haven are trying to face girls like Linda and Mary with reality as it is. We have 7 levels of growth. The program lasts about 18 months. And during this time, girls try to go through growing pains, grow up without needing drugs.
How long, if I can ask Mary and Linda now, how long have you each been at Village Haven?
I've been at the Village Haven for 8 months.
I've been there for about 5 weeks now.
And how long before that did you start using drugs?
4 years.
3 years.
Is anyone interested in knowing why?
I'd like to. Were you on drugs continuously for 4 years and 3 years?
I was on some form of drugs. I started smoking pot and tripping on acid and got into barbiturates, amphetamines, and finally the last step into heroin. I was a heroin addict for 2 years until I came to the Haven.
Well, I had been using drugs since the age of 12, but I didn't start using heroin until 3 years prior to now, my entering the Village Haven. I had used all sorts of narcotics, and I started smoking marijuana at a young age, and I felt that it wasn't necessary. You know, I mean, it didn't do anything to me after a while, and I went on to other things.
Was this some type of search for something? I mean, you know, like some people move on to drugs because of some spiritual, you know, search, looking for something spiritual. Others, maybe for some type of social security. Do you know, sort of retrospectively, looking back on your experiences, do you know why you fell into this type of situation?
Well, I think I fell was because I was so insecure, and yet I wanted something more than just life. I didn't like living an ordinary everyday life without drugs. Therefore, I went to any type of hallucinogenic or hard dope to get away from facing a everyday task.
Do you feel that your step from marijuana and so forth up into heroin and the harder drugs was because of your desire to get a higher high, or because of the people that you associated with, that they were doing this because you felt you wanted to be like them? Or do you think it was because you just wanted something higher, or you weren't satisfied with what you had?
Well, I wanted something more. I wasn't particularly involved with people that were using drugs, but I went looking for them, and I found them, and I just wanted this. I wanted it myself. No one forced me. I don't even think it started at home, because I had a nice situation in the house. I had both of my parents were there and everything. It was just that I wanted kicks. I thought life, you know, was too much for me to deal with. And I wanted to escape it.
Do you feel that if you had not gone searching for these other people, people that were supplying you with this harder, the harder drugs that you would have gone on to barbiturates or heroin or whatever?
Yes, I probably would have, because normally 9 out of 10, the person that sells marijuana, you can find heroin close to it.
I find now that most people that I deal with who turn to some drug, it isn't to gain something positive as to block out something that's uncomfortable, like the Vietnam War or interracial injustice or poverty, that it isn't to gain a positive something, but to block out something that is negative. It's almost like the philosophical definition of evil, which is the absence of good. So if some guy can't deal with the rottenness or corrupt political situation, or he can't deal with the poverty in his neighborhood, instead of doing something about it, he'd like to look at that reality in a different way, on drugs. So it's changing his perspective of it. But it isn't really gaining him something positive as changing the actual reality as it is.
What's the agreement or the disagreement around here? Mary stated that she started because she was looking for kicks. Linda told me before the program that she started strictly out of curiosity. I'm sure everyone here, let's say, knows a friend or knows someone that you could perhaps relate about.
Surely it's just the advance. It's just the way the civilization's progressed. I mean, you say that those drugs change your perspective. It gives you another way of looking at the world. But there again, what about the consumption of alcohol or the television programs or all the other drugs that this society needs, the crutches, to take their mind off the Vietnam War, to release their emotions by watching television or drinking beer? You know, surely it's only relative. It's that we're progressing and that things like marijuana has been used for thousands of years in some civilizations. It goes back to the Greeks and the Egyptians. So I see what you mean, but I can't agree. I think that it's just a progression. It's just the way we're just becoming more liberal. But drugs are any form. Drugs are in food, in pills to calm you down, pills to make you sleep, television programs, drink. They're all forms of drugs. People go out and get in a car and drive for 2 hours because they feel so frustrated.
But you feel this is a progression, an advancement of humanity?
Well, I don't think it's an advancement, but I mean, as we become more technologically minded, as civilization goes, it's like a snowball that starts very small and it just gets larger and more rapid and rapid. The world is going too fast now for a child to be brought up in New York. I mean, now I'm from England, and the first time I ever went to New York, I was terrified. It's just the pace is so fast. How can a child possibly grow up to maturity, to have any values faced with that environment, which is such a very uptight environment? The same with Los Angeles, the same with Chicago and Detroit. It's pushing all the time, you know?
But why don't you take the next step of what your statement is, that if the technological advancement is dehumanizing us so much, why don't we become more human and less chemical? Why don't you really look for human solutions to life's problems instead of drug solutions?
No, but that's the whole point, is that who is looking? Who in New York has got the time to stop? If you were lying in the streets or lying in the doorway, if you were ill, if you just fainted, who out of all those people going down 42nd or 43rd Street, who would stop?
I would.
Who has, one man out of how many living in New York?
All right, then don't you see that's one big mass cop-out that you're giving everybody? You're saying that because no one is doing anything about it, therefore I shouldn't do anything about it.
Do you feel that these people are copping out to do this? I mean, a lot of things are done for, just because you want to do it because you enjoy it. A lot of people, I know, they like to drink beer. So every Saturday night they go out and they drink beer for 4 or 5 hours. Not because they want to get drunk, because they're scared to death of the world, or not because they want to cop out or something like that. But it's for a sheer enjoyment. And if something can be proven, you know, that is not detrimental. I mean, people are going around smoking cigarettes all the time, and this has been proven detrimental to your health. And so if somebody does something, I don't think anybody has the right to say they're all doing it because they want to cop out, or they're all doing it because they want to get a new perspective in it. Everybody, one of the things that's wrong with our society is that you're either a number or a figure or a statistic. And every person, every single person here is different. And every single person who does anything has his reason behind it. It can be similar to somebody else's reason, but yet no matter how much it can be similar, it's never exactly the same. So you can't, you can speak in thousands of people and hundreds and thousands and percentages, but even no matter how far you research something, there's this error in here, because every single person has a completely different reason for doing everything he does.
I think you took me on a beautiful verbal trip. I really don't know what you're saying, man. I'm talking to this particular person, and I said, if he looks at all the mass inactivity, lethargy, don't give a damn attitude in all big cities, that still doesn't excuse him from trying to do something about it. And he can do something about it without smoking a joint. That's all I'm saying.
We've been talking about some kind of general things, and I'd like to get a little more specific. We have Linda and Mary here, and probably at this point we haven't drawn enough on their experience and background and the resources they bring to the show. Could I start off by asking each of you to tell what was the reaction from your parents when they first became aware of the addiction problem that you had?
My parents, they denied the fact that there was a drug problem in the community for a long time, that I was using pot, that I was using acid. They finally found out I was using drugs when I was already addicted to heroin. And I had gotten to the point where I really didn't want to live any longer and had taken an overdose of barbiturates. And when they found out from the ambulance, from the police, I was half dead. And after the initial shock, it hurt them. It really did. And that hurt me because, dude, as much as I complain about the generation gap, I suppose, with my parents, I love them. And it hurt me more that I was hurting them than I was hurting myself.
Mary?
Oh, also with my parents, they were they didn't want to believe it. It's very hard to penetrate to them it was very hard to penetrate to them, to get to them that I really was using heroin. And first thing they thought about was the Joneses, the next door neighbors. And since I wasn't living at home at the time, they liked it like that. They preferred, you know, they knew it was a problem, but as long as I was dealing with it myself or doing what I had to do, it was all right. And, you know, but they still accepted me. I don't say that they just abandoned me altogether. They did not do this. But they really still didn't want to believe it. It was kind of more than they could take. And they're proud of me now that I've gone this far to help myself. Like, I want, you know, anyone here that knows of anybody or is perhaps a user of marijuana to try to stop it before it can develop into something more dangerous than marijuana, because there's no telling where it all might end once you know what one high is, or once you have smoked marijuana, you just might decide that LSD might be better, or any reason, anything to make you go on to another drug other than marijuana. It's very dangerous for that reason, that it will not satisfy you constantly, continuously, throughout a period of your lifetime. You'll never know when you've reached a point where you're just tired of marijuana and you want something more. Let it be pills or LSD.
Mary, I'd like to ask you a question. I'm interested in the idea of the Village Haven. Who sent you there, or did you choose to go, or did your parents suggest it? And what's it like being there? I mean, how do other people treat you, and what's it like there? Does it have any effect on you besides you stop using drugs? I mean, you know, were you sort of ashamed to go there at first of what people might say, or would you just, you know, very vigorous and said, I'm going to go and solve the problem, and, you know, it's all for me, I don't care what other people think?
Well, there are various ways you can get into the Village Haven. One way is by court. Through court, they parole or give a girl probation to do at the Village Haven, preferably rather than jail. And the way I got there was at the hospital where I was at, the social worker, she tried to find me a rehab center, and I told her I didn't want just a day program, because to me, most day programs, you can go in and spend all day there, but when you go out, that's when you have to really see if you're strong enough to stay away, you know, from drugs. And the first one she gave me happened to be the Village Haven, and I called, and then I had an interview with Father Egan about 2 days later, a day later, and I was accepted, fortunately. There was enough space at the time, but this does not happen in every situation.
Well, how do you make the distinction, Father Egan, of who goes and who stays? Because I know it must be awfully hard to say, you know, if a person really has a drug problem and to say, well, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't have room, or there's other people who I feel would get more out of the program. How do you draw the line?
We draw the line by finding out who is begging for help. Until a person begs for help, we can't really give it. We try to measure a girl's motivation. What is my life worth? And what do I want to do about saving it? I'm losing it. What am I willing to invest in saving my life and making something of myself as a human being? And that's why we create a lot of pressure at the Village Haven. Most people don't like pressure. They can't deal with it. So the pressure at the Village Haven makes a girl grow up or leave. So we have 7 levels of growth. The first 30 days you're confined. You can't leave. No privileges except the privilege of being alive and being there, not in the morgue or not in the streets. After 30 days you move up to level 2, then they increase the responsibilities before you get any more privileges, and you keep moving up this way for about 18 months.
How many girls do you currently have at New Haven?
We now have 37 girls at the Village Haven. Our capacity is 42.
What happened to those other few spaces? Because I'm sure there's plenty of other people who would like to get in, and I'm sure these girls feel very happy that they did get in. What happened to the other spaces?
Well, we got girls waiting in prison who could get a conditional release until we find room for them. We're trying to get another building to rehabilitate it before the building can rehabilitate the girls. So we're getting another building, we hope, please God. So we take a lot of risks. We can't predict. A little bit less than half of all the girls who come to the Village Haven split the first month. If they get by the first month, every girl who's reached level 5, not one has gone back to drugs, but even that isn't a success. That's saying what they ain't. I ain't a dope fiend. But like, man, that's only saying what you ain't. What are you? Well, Linda may become a nurse. Mary may become a secretary. I don't know. One may become a dental technician. We've convinced the state, the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation, to spend a little bit money to educate a girl rather than spend $15 a day to keep her in prison.
I'd like to ask Linda a question specifically. You said you've only been in the program for 5 weeks, which is not a very long time, so I'm sure you're not exactly sure where you're going. But do you think when you get through, or when you split, do you think you'll go back to drugs, or you're just totally now finished with them forever?
I hope not. That's about all I can say. I didn't get high yesterday. I'm not going to get high for the rest of today, and I'll take tomorrow as it comes. And there are ex-addicts who've been clean for 10 years now, and they've still got to take one day at a time. Because I can't sit here and say I don't want to get high now, and I never want to get high again, but I can say that it's not worth the price to me. That for all the crap that I've had to take, it's just not worth those few hours of being away from it all.
So one of the things we do at the Haven, we have a lot of group therapy. And a girl may, you know, I feel like shooting dope. But one of the standard rules of the Haven, don't act off your feelings. talk about your feelings, look at them, but don't act on them. If I feel like shooting dope, man, we all feel like shooting dope. We know we're not going to do it. It's only when feeling and thinking fuse that you have a happy person. But if feelings get ahead of your thinking, and you're always acting on feeling, you're not doing much thinking.
What about the personnel
At the Village Haven, we have we are professionally oriented. We have a part-time psychiatrist, two part-time psychologists, psychiatric social worker, two people with MAs and guidance, one MA in behavioral change. We have a good staff. And so we're professionally oriented. We don't buy the fact that only addicts understand addicts.
One more thing. How are you funded? I'm very curious because this must be a terribly expensive thing to do.
The New York State Narcotic Control Commission funds us in most of the things that we need. But like we need to fix three showers upstairs, we got to do that. We got to, the girls have been painting all week, we got to do this. We do some things ourselves. We got to get another building. We get the building, then the state may help us once we get the building. But we got to do our thing instead of blaming the state.
Linda, yes. Well, I was just curious. You said before you had taken a lot of crap and you've had a lot of problems. I was wondering, what is all this that you keep saying it's not worth doing over again? What is all the crap that you got?
Once I became a junkie, once I was physically addicted to heroin, at the beginning it went smoothly. I was working as a secretary. The problem was my habit increased and my salary didn't. And I started shoplifting, you know, boosting from the stores. Eventually, I actually got into prostitution, even though I hate to say it. I'd gotten to the point where I would do anything and everything to get that dope. It had become, getting high on heroin wasn't a high anymore, it was a way of life. It had gotten to the point where everything I was trying to escape, like getting away from everything in this world, I had to still deal with the world because I had to go out and steal from the society. I still had to come in contact with it, and things were worse than the world I was trying to get away from to begin with.
Once you have reached a certain stage, do you rejoin your parents, or do you have meetings with your parents, or you just go it alone?
After 30 days, after your 30 days of isolation, where your privilege, like Father Egan said, is being alive to scrub floors or whatnot, you're allowed contact with your family. We have visiting nights once a week. You have a day for phone call, and you do get that help.
What is the usual reaction of your parents once you've reached the past the 30-day stage?
My parents came Saturday. I saw my parents for the first time in a month. And my mother was crying with happiness because she was proud of me, that I was trying to finally help myself. She knew she couldn't help me. It was my problem. And I think most parents, I think it's safe to say, are really proud of their kids, that we're trying to help ourselves.
Does this affect your brothers and sisters, too? I mean, like, would it... Could you say that it might stop them from taking drugs once they've seen you reach past this 30-day period or further?
I don't know if it's so much a 30-day period, but just the idea of what we've been through and that we're finally trying to change. Yes, I think it will influence my brothers and sisters. My little brother and sister came with my mother on Saturday. And that and the combination of the education they are now getting, even in elementary school, that they're a little more hip to what's happening before they get into it, before it's too late. And I hope they'll learn through my mistakes.
You feel the education's more truthful now than it was before? Like, once I saw a poster where it said, marijuana kills. I knew it didn't kill, but I saw the poster, and now they don't have the poster up anymore. They took it down. But is education more truthful towards drugs now?
It's gotten to the point, the education about drugs isn't preaching anymore. It's just stating more or less factually, this is what each drug can do to you. Not necessarily that it will, but besides, it used to be two extremes. The kids who were using the drugs were glorifying, and the people against them were coming up with absurd statements like, marijuana will kill. But now the education is factual, and in the long run, then it's up to everybody to decide for themselves.
Do you feel now the point has been reached where the addicts could confront the government and talk it out and have the government react with definite action, positive rather than negative?
I think it's the people who do have power that have got to talk with the government, the people in the government that have got to realize.
Well, you've got to talk to the people that do have power, which are mostly in government or economic highly economic states, well, they positively react now, or most negative reactions, like prisons and put you away so you're not in contact with the rest of the world.
I think maybe Father should answer that as far as reactions.
Well, look, this is a reaction. I think the government isn't able to say it as well as we can say it, or like I can say it. I didn't know I needed glasses until I put them on, and man, did I need them. There are a lot of kids looking at this program, a lot of you here, this, who don't know you hurt because you've always hurt. That's a fact. A lot of kids are shy. They've always been shy. They don't even know they're shy because they've always been shy. A lot of kids are in love. They've never been loved, and so they're so used to it, they think it's normal. They're halfway through a joint. Now, hear me. I'm not saying this is going to happen to everybody, but it's a risk everybody has to look at. That I may like what marijuana does to me emotionally, and I may go back to it and go back to it and emotionally need it. That's why I'd rather deal with a physical addiction than an emotional addiction. No matter what Dr. Margaret Mead says or anybody else says, that an emotional dependence on a drug is far more difficult to deal with. So that if someone keeps going back and back to marijuana because I need it, it helps me to relate, man. It helps me to talk, man. It shuts out my father, man. It helps me to... Well, what's really happening is that they need it emotionally. Then a few weeks later, man, I got the bread. Where's the grass? I haven't got no grass. I got some smack. At that moment, whatever is available, if I need it, there's the risk that everyone has to take. I may need it if I start experimenting. So we're only here to say, why experiment? People can help you more than drugs. That's a fact.
Father, why did you originally start working with women, or was it just that your first contact with this sort of work was with a female, or was this a conscious decision by yourself to work only with women, or are you working with both male and female?
I'm working 99% with women, but meeting them, meet all their guys, their old man, my husband, or whatever he is. The first person I met was a woman. I canvassed New York State. There wasn't a bed in the whole state for a female addict. If she had syphilis, she had cancer, if she had anything else, they'd take her in. I began working in the Women's House of Detention in New York City, and 18,000 girls go through there every year, and 90% of them are drug addicts. There was help for women. We always accepted the fact of a fallen man, but not a woman. And when a woman falls, she falls lower than any man. There's more guilt in 10 women than 100 men. It's harder to rehabilitate a girl than a guy. So we, the Village Haven, hooked up with the women prisons in New York State, and we've stayed with them.
Father, have you ever had a girl split from your village and then want to come back? Have you ever had that situation occur?
Yes. If a girl splits, say, on level 1 or level 2 or level 3, rarely does anyone split at 4, level 4. But if someone splits, then they have to... when a girl wants to split, by the way, she goes out the way she came in, unless she wants to go out the window. But if she, it's not a prison. That's the most painful thing, that the door is open, they can leave. So if a girl wants to leave, we ring the bell, the whole house comes down, and we challenge her for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour. Where are you going, nut? What are you going to do tonight? Where are you going to sleep? How are you going to act? By the time she wants to leave, she stops thinking and she's only feeling. So the whole house starts to think for her, and then sometimes she doesn't split. Like we have a Pennsylvania girl now who is splitting every hour in the hour, but she hasn't left yet. But if someone does split... If someone does split, it takes her 30 days to come back.
But she can come back.
She can, but she's got to suffer that thing outside. You made the responsible decision to leave. A girl did this about 3 months ago, and she was dead 4 hours later of an overdose.
I'd like to ask exactly what do you do? You know, you've talked vaguely about your different activities, but not directly. What do you do, like, during the first period when you're isolated? What are your activities?
We daily, hourly face them with responsibilities. And that's the secret of rehabilitating anybody, helping anyone to grow up. Face them with reality, responsibilities. You don't like your gray wall? Well, look, nut, you don't have to take an acid trip to change that wall. Here's a can of paint. Do something about it. You want something, invest something in it. Responsibilities. If Mary doesn't like working in the laundry, we say, fine, that's why we got you there, to deal with difficult things you don't want to face. I like working in the kitchen. Okay, we'll take you out of the kitchen because it's too comfortable. We won't let someone just live in comfort. So hour by hour, we face them with reality and responsibilities and the ability to talk something out. That's the most beautiful thing about the Village Haven, the group therapy we have, where people can really, you know, when I sit down in my group and I tell her how I feel, they tell me how they feel, we identify. We're all human beings. And this, to me, is the tragedy, that human beings don't trust human beings as much as they trust acid. That human beings can sit around. I defy any one of you to say that you can find three honest people on this earth and you're wealthy if you have three friends. If you could sit with three friends, I say that you could solve any problem with three beautiful, wonderful human beings without turning to drugs. And we do this in group therapy.
Could I ask, I know that Linda mentioned that she has younger brothers and sisters. I don't know if you have brothers and sisters, Mary. Do you?
Yes, I have one sister, but she's older than me.
What would you do? Let me ask you, what would you do if you found out that your brothers or sister or brothers and sisters were addicted?
I would pray. But, of course, prayer doesn't always get it either. Because a person that once starts using heroin specifically, they have to go through a whole lot of changes, more so than a person that uses anything else, I think. I know this to be true in our house. Most of the girls that are there have been on drugs for maybe years. And like they have came to different programs, they've stopped for a while, they've been imprisoned. That means stopping. And they've always gone back. It seems like they have to go downhill to the bottom, really, to rock bottom before they realize. Like nowadays, the younger generation is what we're trying to stop. The 17-year-olds, the 12-year-olds that are dying since the beginning of the year, those are the ones we're really trying to help. And, like, it's hard. It's really hard. You have to use everything that you have, and you have to keep using it. You can't stop. You can't give up.
So what would you do about your sister, though? You didn't have, your sister started to mess around with drugs, and you found out your sister was a heroin addict. What would you do?
First, I would try and get her into a program. I would try and make her clean herself up, you know, to get rid of her habit physically. And then I would try to get her into a program where, in which I knew she would get help.
Girls, I'd like to ask you a question. If it comes a time where you've married and such things and you have kids, or even if you're not married and you have kids, what would you do to try and make your children stay away from drugs, or would you just come out and say, don't touch them, don't mess with them? How would you react towards it? And once, if they did go to it, what would you do? There is even closer to home.
If I had kids, if they were, once anybody's on drug, whether it'll be my younger sisters and brothers, or, you know, eventually when I have a family, the only thing I can do is sit and talk to them and convince them to help themselves. Because, like Mary said, most people have to reach their own rock bottom point. As far as what to do to prevent them from taking drugs, what I've sensed is that there are two reasons why most people start. A lot of it is spare time and boredom in your spare time. Another reason is isolation and nobody to talk to. As a parent, I think any parent can provide the communication and solve that problem. And as far as boredom, parents, school recreational programs, and whatnot can be arranged to alleviate the boredom. And that takes care of really the main two causes, I think, why people start on drugs.
A lot of people feel that our society today lets us too much leisure time, and people now are trying to make it so they have less hours of work and more leisure. Now, the way you're talking about it, it sounds as if the whole society needs a complete changeover, and that entails an awful lot. So how do you suggest, like, going to a recreation center doesn't mean that you're not going to be bored. You know, you're going to sit there, you're going to play basketball, you're going to be with these kids, you're going to play tennis, you know, it depends. But you sound as if the whole society needs a complete changeover. What can you do for that?
What would have to, if I had kids... If the laws were changed in my church that I could get married, I probably wouldn't anyway. But say, if I had kids, one of the things that I would hit my kids with is the reality, hey, kid, little nut, Boredom is part of life. Boredom didn't suddenly come on the scene. When I was young, I was bored, too. It's what we do with boredom that really matters. I would convince my kids that life was never meant to be easy. And that there are a lot of difficulties and trials and frustrations that are part of life. How many roads must a man walk down before he becomes a man? Little six-year-old. Mommy, where are my stockings? In a ball where you threw them. They're not my stockings. Where's my history book? I don't have my history book. Face responsibilities. You know, the kids have to be taught today that life is difficult, and we must face these difficulties without trying to run away from them.
I wanted to ask you, the two girls, one question. And, Mary, you said that if you had a person, a brother or sister who was on drugs, that you would pray. And that brought to mind what goes on within Billy Chavin. Is prayer an integral part of your program, or is it just something that developed from within you? From a need, or is it given to you with the breakfast that you get in the morning? Curious.
Village Haven is non-sectarian. There is no demands made on you because Father Egan is a Catholic. I'm not Catholic, I'm Jewish. No, but the point is your religion is your own thing. You know, nobody cares if you don't want to pray to anybody. If you want to pray to, you know, a little stone Buddha in your room, you can do that too. There is no religious demands made on us. Religion isn't rammed down our throat as a part of rehabilitation. It's your own choice.
Hey, speaking of responsibility as we were, it is mine to inform everyone that we've run out of time. Father Egan, thanks to you, and I hope that the acquisition of buildings and funds goes well for you at Village Haven. To the two girls, Mary and Linda, what can we say except wish you well, and also, as a personal thing, I think that what you did today took a hell of a lot of guts, and I think that we're very appreciative of you coming out and sharing yourselves with us. Donald Leese and I will be back next week. Just as we go, I'd like to also thank Fred, who's sitting right next to me, for spilling a soft drink on my leg, keeping me cool throughout the thing. And if you'll look there, you'll see the people who will be with us next week. We're going to take a look at drugs next week through a physician's eyes. The physician is Dr. Joel Fort, who's the author of a book called The Pleasure Seekers.
The thing I've most advocated for about a decade and have been in the forefront of trying to bring about in this country is to take the drug user entirely out of the criminal law. Whether it be the illegal user of alcohol and tobacco, of marijuana, or other drugs.
Possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.